You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of January 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, with tensions between Iran and Saudi Arabia at an all-time high, my guests today weigh in on the escalating crisis and predict what might happen next. Plus, we'll explore the future of open borders in Europe, discuss Volkswagen's many legal woes, and look at the latest legislation tackling the gun crisis in the USA. All that and more besides, starting right now here on Midori House. Yes, a warm welcome to Midori House. I'm Tom Edwards. My guests today are regular Monocle 24 contributors Jane Kinnamont and Tim Marshall. Jane's a senior research fellow and deputy head of the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House. Tim's a journalist and writer, former diplomatic editor at Sky News and now editor of the whatandthewhy.com. Welcome both to the programme. Great to have you with us, of course. Let's kick off with the geopolitical story of the week. Two of the Middle East's most powerful countries, their most famous rivals, Saudi Arabia and Iran, trading diplomatic barbs in a tit-for-tat escalation that's causing analysts, some at least, to fear the worst. Riyadh and Tehran have, of course, been foes for as long as many can remember, but this latest round of insult trading comes at a particularly sensitive time in the region. Jane, maybe you can bring us up to date, or, well, I suppose in many ways actually sort of go back and explain, if it's possible to, succinctly, the genesis of this row. Obviously, we've had the execution of the cleric or clerics by Saudi. It's considered an incendiary gesture, but how does that fit into the bigger picture of this sort of enmity between these two?
Well, there are long-standing rivalries between Iran and Saudi Arabia, but relations haven't always been as bad as they are today. At times, they go through phases of wanting sort of peace and cooperation, but really, since the invasion of Iraq, there's been a sense in Saudi Arabia that Iran is on the rise. That's something that's been compounded by the recent nuclear deal. Iran feels that now it's no longer so isolated and contained by the US that it can play what it would see as its rightful role in the Middle East. Conversely, Saudi Arabia says, well, no one asked us. This is an Arab region. The Iranians are radicals, etc. They are destabilising. We don't want this to happen. So it's against this sense that large-scale regional geopolitics are changing, potentially to Iran's advantage, that Saudi Arabia is particularly paranoid about Iranian involvement, including Iranian influence over its own Shia minority. Now, Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr, the cleric who was recently executed, is a Saudi national. He has been accused of links with Iran, but he was probably executed more because Saudi Arabia doesn't tolerate domestic dissent than anything else. He was a fierce critic of the Saudi ruling family. But Iran has used the case to position itself as an international defender of Shia rights. After all, Iran executes plenty of people itself, including Sunni clerics who have been on death row. It's hardly speaking as a big defender of human rights. And this has just escalated because of the bigger tensions between the two countries. Now you have diplomatic relations cut off, Saudi Arabia saying there will be no more flights, no more trade with Iran, and other Arab countries kind of caught in the middle. Most of them don't quite want to follow suit.
Well, I want to ask you about that, because it's clearly in the face of that and this perception of this inexorable rise of Iran from the Saudi side, at least, you know, a very deliberate and calculated gesture. What was the objective? I mean, it's clearly incendiary, as I mentioned, and you've described very eloquently the background to it. Why now, then, and why this manoeuvre particularly, do you think?
Well, to be quite cynical about it, there are leaders in both countries who probably benefit from the sense in their countries of a strong domestic enemy. So for Saudi Arabia, it's also bearing in mind that it is cracking down on and executing Sunni dissidents who are involved with Islamic State or Al-Qaeda. So, strangely enough, some people in Saudi Arabia see this as a kind of weird even-handedness, that if you are being tough on the Sunni extremists, here is a Shia preacher who said many things against the country's rulers and was seen by them as incendiary. So this is fairness in a strange sort of way. Meanwhile, Iran is going through a huge and very difficult transformation, which could be not unlike what happened to the Soviet Union, that it's trying to go from a country founded on an anti-American revolution to a country that sort of does business with the US. How do you do that? It may be quite useful for them to have a new bogeyman, to make Saudi Arabia the number one enemy ahead of the US, ahead of even Israel.
A bit of political expediency wouldn't be that surprising.
Always.
Tim, if we take a step back then and look at what this means, I guess the bigger picture for the region particularly, I mean, Jane already talked about, you know, Iraq maybe being the flashpoint for this latest descent, if you like. You've got this instability in Syria as well. What does what we're seeing between these two mean for the region, including those two flashpoints in particular?
It's more than unfortunate. It's going to cost a lot of lives in various ways. I mean, you can go all the way back to the 6th century and the split in the schism in Islam between Sunni and Shia, but let's not start there. I'll start just last year when the new king in Saudi Arabia wants to make his mark. This was about the same time that the Iranian got their deal. And the new king wants to make his mark. His son, Crown Prince Salman, seems to be driving a lot of the things that the Saudis are doing. They've gone into Yemen. They are stoking the flames a lot. They're stoking the flames in Syria. And so it's come at a very bad time. So if we now project forward, there's three fairly quick things that might happen. There are a bunch of Qataris that are currently held hostage by a Shia militia in the south of Iraq. This Shia militia had asked for the Sheikh Nimir to be released, and then they would release the Qatari. It's just a hunting group. They were caught, tourists. Very unfortunate. They may die. Secondly, there's now a question mark over the vote about the Lebanese president. They've had 34 efforts at getting a new president. Basically, because of the dynamics of the Middle East, the Saudis and the Iranians sign off. Okay, we both agree this is a compromise candidate. You can be president of Lebanon. They were about to have that vote. That might fall. But the biggest thing for me is Syria. For the first time, the Iranians and the Saudis had agreed to sit round the table with everybody else and talk about how to get a peace deal going. Now, the peace deal's a bit of a long shot anyway. This has not helped.
It's interesting. I don't know, particularly when Tim talks about, you know, going back, you know, 1,500 years or whatever it is. To what extent, Jane, can we look at the events of the last week, I suppose, or maybe the last 12 to 18 months for a fuller picture and say, actually, this does explain, you know, almost everything that's going wrong in the Middle East and the wider area? Is it a microcosm? Does it demonstrate or explain the way the wider problems?
It's certainly not purely a religious or theological problem, because much of the time you have Sunni and Shia communities coexisting perfectly peacefully, especially in countries where the states treat them as equals. But religious differences are definitely part of the problem. Many Shia communities worldwide are interpreting Saudi Arabia's actions simply as sectarian. They think they targeted Sheikh Nimr because he was Shia. This is massively oversimplified, but it's a perception that's out there. And conversely, there can be the equivalent view among the leaders of Saudi Arabia that the Shia are somehow all blind followers of Iran because they share the same religious interpretation. So it complicates it.
And what about, Tim, I wanted to ask you, I mean, we've talked often before about the Israel-Palestine conflict, and I don't know, there's been a sense, I guess, over certainly the last couple of years, as Obama's, you know, impotence at driving that deal forward and other factors, that that's sort of faded somewhat into the background. And when people talk about, you know, the most pressing problems for the region,
that's where it's going to stay.
Well, but does this then materially change anything, or it just guarantees that it's going to be parked there for longer even than people were fearing?
Well, people had already, I think most sensible people had got over the idea that if you solve Israel-Palestine, you solve the Middle East. I mean, you know, that was always a lie, and now it's been proven to be a lie. So that will remain in the background, constant unpleasantness and violence, but it's not going to go away. The only thing that impacts on Israel-Palestine is the position of Hezbollah. Hezbollah are trying to heat up the border a little bit, but really they're very, very busy. They're a Shia militia in Lebanon, they're very busy. It is much more than just religion. Nevertheless, there is a clear divide, Shia, Sunni. Egypt has been muted, has criticised Iran for allowing the Saudi embassy to be trashed in Tehran, even though an Egyptian national was one of the people executed. But they've got big deals going with Saudi. That's why they positioned themselves where they positioned themselves. Kuwait doesn't want to go as far as breaking relations because it has a very sizable Shia minority in Kuwait, so it has criticised but has not broken relations. Bahrain, led by a Sunnis but with a Shia majority, has gone with the Saudis because they're tight with them. The UAE, who are tight, which is a Sunni majority. So it actually, the politics does split down the religious lines, which is pretty unfortunate. It was the king of Jordan named it with of the Shia arc of instability, about 8 years ago now. I mean, he was widely criticised for actually saying what we all knew, because you're not supposed to talk about these things. But they are in the middle of a massive problem that began about 10 years ago, exacerbated by the invasion of Iraq, but really going back to 1979 and the Iranian Revolution. They see themselves as the spokespeople for Muslims all over the world. The Saudis see themselves as spokespeople for Muslims all over the world, the guardians of the two holy mosques. And it's been going on for 10 years now, and I see no end in sight.
Given that sort of fragmented and complex picture, Jane, we did say at the top of the show, we'll cast an eye to the future and try and predict what happens. We don't shy away from the difficult question, so I'll pose one to you. What happens next? Does this continue to simmer away unpleasantly? Could it boil over? A lot of people saying, well, how bad could this get now? What's your instincts?
I think the negatives are that the conflicts already existing in Syria and Yemen could spread. People in Iraq, in Lebanon, as Tim mentioned, even in Afghanistan, Kashmir, they will all be watching this really nervously because they could become part of this proxy
Iraq,
war.
Sorry to interrupt, Jane. There's been two bombings of Sunni mosques in the south of Iraq, which is Shia dominated. I mean, this has the potential to get a lot of people killed. War between the two main players, I doubt, but the proxy wars that Jane has mentioned, they will fuel those. Sorry to interrupt.
That's right. No, I fully agree. And basically, these countries are actually not, Saudi Arabia and Iran are not stupid. They don't want to go to war directly with each other. Iran has a much bigger army. Saudi Arabia has the backing of the US. So they always shy away from that. But they may increasingly stir up trouble by supporting each other's dissidents. They're already accusing each other of doing that. That could become more real. There's certainly going to be many angry young men among Sheikh Nimr's followers who are now likely to be more radicalised. And one of the things that really worries me is a region dominated by, or at least demographically dominated by, people who are under 30, who are finding it more and more difficult to get jobs. Unemployment is on the rise. The economies are mostly stagnating. The fall in the oil price is compounding all of that. And angry young men across the Arab world are growing up, seeing a world where the sectarian divide is the dominant feature. It was different for their fathers or for their grandfathers, who might remember a different time. But this generation is going to really struggle to end these conflicts.
You just look at the mixed marriages. The rate of mixed marriages 10 years ago was far higher than the rate of mixed marriages is now, which is very sad.
It is indeed. Well, it's a grimly compelling narrative, and I'm sure we'll be returning to it in the weeks and months ahead. Let's move, though, to Europe next, where the future of borderless travel on the continent is in increasing peril, seemingly. This week, Sweden reintroduced ID checks on its border with Denmark. The Danes followed suit on their border with Germany. It comes, of course, in the midst of the worst refugee crisis in Europe since the Second World War. Tim, I think I've probably asked you this question before, but I'll ask it again in the light of what we've seen in the last 48 hours or so. Is Schengen, the Schengen agreement, the Schengen dream, is it done for?
I believe so, but you know, there are many powerful forces within the Schengen 26 countries that don't want it to die, and will try to make sure that it doesn't. But there's two things that have gone on which are connected. In fact, they're connected really back to the previous story. And that is the massive waves of refugees and migrants coming up through Europe. There's then the terror attacks in Paris, which are linked. And at that point, the populations of many of the 26 Schengen countries say something must be done. And what must be done if you want to get re-elected next time and you want to watch the right wing not get too big in your country is you start cracking down, which is why Denmark and Sweden today, the Swedes have closed this. Well, they haven't closed the bridge, but there's this incredibly symbolic bridge, the Öresund Bridge. But they've been having 1,000 people a week coming across it and claiming asylum through Germany, into Denmark, up through Sweden. And so they've closed it and they've said, right, you need to show your papers before you can get in. That's going to create a bottleneck in Denmark. So Denmark has said, further south, looking at their border with Germany, well, we're going to start cracking down on our border. And that is how Schengen will die. And I think the trajectory is that Schengen will die. I think the trajectory is that Europe, and I've been arguing this for about a year now, it's wrong to think of it as the European Union fortress EU. You need to start looking at it as EU individual states being fortress nation states. Mm.
Jane, it's interesting though, isn't it? Because a lot of people, when they talk about the whole European project, this is front and centre. They talk about the ease of movement for work, for any sorts of travel, as being, you know, the sort of the most explicitly, well, it was the most explicitly sort of realisable goal at the beginning. It was something people could understand, they've bought into. Are we in the death throes of Schengen? Do you agree with Tim, or do you retain some optimism, or well, I don't know, a different view potentially?
Well, I think for most people in the world, this story itself is slightly hard to understand because most people have to deal with ID checks and borders every, you know, any time. And this has been a remarkable sort of crossing, not only because there's been no such checks, but it's also dead cheap. It's cheaper to travel between these countries.
But it's a regular commuting route, we should point out. Thousands of people doing this both ways every day.
People from Sweden go to Denmark for a drink because the alcohol laws are much laxer, and the Danes complain that the Swedes are responsible for all the drunkenness and so forth. But it's much cheaper than even going from England to Scotland, or certainly from London to Paris. By itself, ID checks won't necessarily cause huge problems for the majority of people that are travelling between those two countries, but it does spotlight, as Tim mentions, a much, much bigger issue, which is Schengen, you know, can it really survive at all unless you had real coordination of refugee policy and also intelligence policies across Europe, and it's not clear people have the appetite for that either.
You've got a lot of people say, oh, isn't it awful? And yes, it is awful, because I see that bridge as symbolic of how life can be, of how nations can be, how people can be. It's absolutely wonderful. That's the liberal side of me. But I've been reading a lot of stuff today saying, oh, this is terrible, you know, how dare the Swedes do this and this. But the Swedes have had 166,000 asylum applications. It's not a very populous country, 166,000. So I would say to the people that wring their hands and say, no, you should have the open borders, my heart agrees with you, but if you project forward at 166,000 people a year coming in, do you realise what will happen in Sweden? Do you realise the backlash that will come? Do you realise the political parties that you will see down the line in a few years' time? They will not be pretty. And I think just saying, oh no, you need to let everyone in comes, you're actually undermining the very values that you actually believe in the long run. It is not the answer to what is one of the greatest problems of our generation.
Well, let's move on. And before we head to a break, I want to talk about something of a day of reckoning yesterday for the embattled automaker Volkswagen, at least in the United States. The Justice Department there sued the company this week, seeking billions of dollars in penalties after it emerged previously that Volkswagen had engaged in cheating, misleading emissions tests. I think it's interesting from a number of perspectives, of course. The numbers are quite scary, Jane. What about from the brand perspective? Is this a brand, you know, a trusted brand? Has it been damaged irreparably? Would you be heading to your local VW dealership? Or is it, again, is it not quite as simple as that?
I think it's damaging for a brand that very much focuses on sort of quality and reliability. It's still unclear how widespread these practices were, though, in the rest of the autos industry.
What do you think, Tim? Was this a tip of an iceberg of sort of subterfuge from a number of other?
Suspect that it is, but I mean, I don't know that, and I have no proof. And at the moment, it just seems to be VW, which I think in Europe the brand has taken a hammering. I think sales worldwide sales are down about 20%, but I think it is such a loved brand and known brand, they probably will get over it. But I looked at some of the facts and figures today. There's been a 6% drop in their share price today, and that is because, and this, I haven't followed the story really that closely, but I was astonished when the US Justice Department said they're going to sue them today for $90 billion.
It bears repeating, because that's a big number. Yeah.
Several times, let's repeat it. Because they thought it was going to be about $20 billion, and suddenly it's $90 billion. So that's why the share price has gone through the floor. And I think in America, where they've never really had that much traction, I think they have a very big long-term problem of ever getting traction now. I suspect they'll bounce back in Europe. But hey, you know, this is, I'm out of my comfort zone on this one.
Okay, well, we'll be back in America, actually, when we return after a short break. Jane Kinnamont and Tim will still be with us. We'll also talk about violence in Cologne and the potential nuts and bolts of a Brexit vote. Stay with us.
How much information can you pack into a minute? Every morning, the Monocle Minute wings its way into your inbox, packed with the very latest news and views from around the world, all delivered with a monocle twist. We'll tell you what that new aircraft carrier means for Southeast Asia, why the next EU summit will be more interesting than normal, and what to look out for at an upcoming election. We'll pick out the latest retail trend in Latin America, analyse the aviation news in Australia, and take a tour of a neighbourhood that's on the up. And there's more. At the weekend, we'll review the best new restaurants, give you the lowdown on that art exhibition you've been meaning to visit, and dissect the best of the latest fashion week. See? There's rather a lot you can pack into a minute. Sign up now at monocle.com/minute.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Still with us here in Studio One, Tim Marshall from the whatandthewhy.com and Jane Kinnamont from Chatham House. Let's turn next to President Obama's executive action on gun control in the United States. Obama's just wrapped up a fairly emotional press conference less than an hour ago in which he lamented the lives lost due to gun violence in the country. Obama announced new gun control measures, essentially circumventing Congress with the president's privilege of what's called executive action. Despite that, Congress still needs to act, he said, quite literally wiping away the tears. I mean, Jane, we've seen from Obama before a level of frustration, a sort of disappointment almost at, I don't know, his inability and the constant stream of these terrible gun crimes. Is this any sort of a turning point? Or do you think, as always, sadly, you know, in another month, 2 months, we're going to be sat here again talking about the latest atrocity?
It's certainly a bold move given how incredibly divisive this issue is in the US. It's something that no doubt will be fodder for the next election campaign as well, and might be something that any future Republican president would seek to reverse quite quickly.
Is this one of those unwinnable arguments, Tim? We've talked about them before. Do you think that somebody at some point can get some traction in the US on this?
At some point, but not in the foreseeable future. But that doesn't mean you stop having the argument. I mean, look, I am on this particular subject. I think the president is on the right side of the argument. I'm not a big fan or I'm not a big enemy of Obama. Something's good, something's bad. On this one, I think he's bang on. And yeah, it was a very emotional press conference, and he was.
Did that surprise you? I mean, we're not really used to seeing our leaders showing that sort of raw emotion, are we?
Well, there's a number of things going on. A, he's a very humane person. Also, he knows who disproportionately get the brunt of gun crime. But also, I thought at the beginning of the presidency 7 years ago, he has three things that he really, really cares about. One was nuclear arms control, which I think this explains the Iran deal, which I'm not particularly a fan of. Two, healthcare. Got through a flawed healthcare system. And now in his last year, he's turning to what I think is his third emotional button to press. Now, he was busy in the first term, but that's when he had a majority, Democrats. He hasn't got the majority anymore. So I think what he's doing is moving the conversation. I've had several minutes of legal training, so bear with me. My understanding of this is, and this is how he's trying to move the debate. At the moment, the law says you must have background checks if you are engaged in the business of selling weapons. It's the terminology, engaged in the business. So what he's going to try and do is get that identified better, because at the moment, if you are a single individual, you're not engaged in the business. If I sell my rifle to you, I don't have to have a background check. If I'm a dealer, I do. But what is between those two points? What if I sell a gun every 5 weeks? What if I sell my collection of 20 guns? So he's trying to nail down what it means to be engaged in the business. And that is how the argument will be won. It'll be won incrementally, year by year. I looked at the figures, 280,000 Americans killed by guns in the last 10 years. 60% of them are suicide, says the gun lobby. So it's only about 32,000 that have been murdered by guns in America a lot more than terrorism.
We've had some pretty scary numbers on this programme already. James, on this then, do you agree with Tim? Do you think it is that there can be incremental progress? Or is this an issue that precisely because of the divisiveness that you described initially, it requires some kind of, you know, a moment, some sort of cathartic point to move on? Or do you think it can happen in the way that Tim describes?
Well, there has been incremental change. There are, after all, gun controls in the US, which have come in incrementally, but they're just not as strong as they are in most other Western countries. I mean, it's possible the fact that guns have been used in the most recent terrorist incident in the US and, of course, to lethal effect in the Paris attacks, where they were much, much more lethal than suicide bombers. That might be something that could sway some on the more right-wing side to just allow a few more constraints while still expressing their support overall for a right to bear arms that they think is enshrined in the Constitution.
I got my maths wrong, Tom, sorry, but it still runs at 11,000 homicides a year from guns.
That's an astonishing number. Let's jump back across the Atlantic to Europe. I want to talk about events in Cologne next. The city's mayor has summoned police over an outbreak of attacks by gangs of young men on women across the city on New Year's Eve. Around 80 women reported offences, including sexual assaults and mugging, prosecuted by as many as 1,000 men arriving in the city. The police chief said it was a new dimension of crime. He also added that the men were of Arab or North African appearance, which has engendered a few different responses. The press, interesting, describing this as sort of terror light, almost, some media across the region. Do you think, Tim, that that sort of language is unhelpful, damaging? Is it labelling something, admittedly terrible, but it's sort of raising what is drunk and disorderly, unacceptable conduct into something else? Is it political? What do you make of it?
Well, it is political because of the things we've been discussing today. I mean, there's no way it cannot be political. I mean, there is a separate argument. Should you ever raise the gender or the race of someone? I mean, a crime is a crime is a crime. The police chief has raised the issue, and there's been a backlash that he should never have said that all he said the culprits were of Arab or North African descent. I think you're putting your head in the sand if you don't. I also agree it is dangerous if you do. So it's a very sensitive area. But the Justice Minister of North Rhine-Westphalia, which is the region of Germany that Cologne is in, he said, "We will not accept that groups of North African men can gather expressly for the purpose of debasing women." And it does seem, according to some of the German media, that there has been a cultural problem where gangs of young men in who've made it to Germany, who have a certain view of Western women, took it upon themselves to get drunk on New Year's Eve and attack Western women in a sexual manner. Now, you've got to report that. And at that point, you say you've got to report it. Do you then report the racial makeup of the attackers? Is it germane to the argument? And I can only think it's germane to the argument if you can then venture that culturally these young men come from an area where they look upon women in the West in a certain way because they haven't quite got their heads around what our sexual freedoms mean to us and how we go about them. Or you are, in fact, verging towards racism, and it's a hell of a delicate argument.
Did you go along with that, Jane? It's just a very unenviable line that people like the officials in Cologne have to walk and tread it as delicately as they can, they must.
Well, they'll be seeking to get more information about what the actual motivations of the attacks were. Was this some kind of big organised gang? I'm not sure that terror parallels make any sense without there being some kind of information about deliberate motivations, well, other than people just...
The 40 arrests made were all of people of Arab or North African descent, but that in itself, maybe, you know, there's nuance in that.
I think it is germane to report on things like ethnicity, age, things like this, where you're trying to identify the nature of this group, but to make the leap into whether this was terrorism rather than something...
Oh, no,
there's
nothing anybody's... Nobody's mentioned, I don't think, this terrorism thing. This is more of a immigrant refugee story and then a cultural story that why did 1,000 people gather? I know that square quite well. It's in between Cologne Cathedral and the main railway station. Very nice big open space. And apparently up to 1,000, many of them in big gangs. And the police say they went there with the express intention of attacking Western women sexually. And if that's the case, you've got to make up your mind who it is you want to defend. And personally, on this particular issue, you want to defend what I regard as the victim.
Absolutely. I'm afraid there we must leave it.
Sorry, Jane.
The clock is against us, Jane. I'm sorry about that. The insights of Tim Marshall and Jane Kinnamon. Thank you both very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House today. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Gaia Lutz and Ilana Hanyukov. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Carlotta Rabello's bringing you music next. 1900 Section D, our design programme. Dominic Reynolds has more on the stories we've been discussing on the Monocle Daily. 2200 London time. We're back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London. Do join us then. Goodbye.